There's a small strip of treeless land at the top of the world that nobody walks on. Well, some do. The caribou visit it every year, and the hardiest of hikers trek there to be in true wilderness. But for the most part, few people give the coastal plain much thought. Yet it's deeply embattled territory. Those who do give it thought are the strategists of some of the world's wealthiest boardrooms, members of Congress, and environmentalists. For there's a 1 in 5 chance that the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge may harbor one of the Arctic's last great oil fields, and the battle rages because it is also prime wilderness land in a world of shrinking spaces. This is Conversations. I'm your host, Susan McInnes. My guest today lends her voice to the battle. Her first book, published in 1990 by Sierra Club, is called Midnight Wilderness, Journeys in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. In the next hour, we'll talk about the book, the history, and the possible futures for ANWR and the Coastal Plain. Please welcome with me Fairbanks resident Debbie Miller. Debbie, give us an aerial snapshot. ANWR lies west of the Canadian border, borders on the Beaufort to
right,
the
borders
north.
To the north.
Mm-hmm. It's north of the Yukon River.
Right.
And the Brooks Range Mountains travel through it, running from east to west, west
right.
to east. What
it's
else?
It's a vast area. I always tell people that it's, and I think this always surprises people, that it's roughly the size of the state of Maine, which it's a huge area. And the only two communities that are anywhere near the Arctic Refuge are Kaktovik, which lies on the north coast on the Beaufort Sea, with a population of a couple of hundred residents. And then you've got Arctic Village, where we lived for a few years, that is on the southern boundary. And that has maybe 150 residents. Right. And beyond that, you have a few trapping families that live year-round in the area. And then it's just a vast wilderness with lots of caribou and grizzly bears and doll sheep and tremendous diversity of wildlife, but very few inhabitants as far as humans.
Mm-hmm. And the tree line stops where? So we're looking mostly at tundra?
We're looking mostly at tundra on the north side of the Brooks Range. There are some trees in the Saddle Roche Mountains. That's an unusual location, some poplars. But as far as spruce trees, your northern limit of trees is about 50 to 60 miles north of Arctic Village, if that gives you sort of a sense.
Right.
It's on the south side of the Brooks Range. Mm-hmm. It's very open. A very open, naked landscape, which I love because you have great visibility, unlimited visibility. You know, you can see just for miles and miles and miles mm-hmm. of wilderness. And when you're out on the coastal plain, you can look north across the Arctic Ocean, the pack ice, and you know you're just, there's nothing out there except polar bears and a few whales that might be migrating by. And, mm-hmm. and beyond that is the North Pole. And unless there's some expedition in progress, there's nobody up there. So you really are on the edge of the continent.
Is it windswept like Barrow and the Prudhoe is?
It can be extremely, you know, and under a lot of conditions, very, very windswept. I've been out there and been freezing in June because of a very high, strong winds that come out of the, particularly the ones that come out of the northeast, mm-hmm. the polar winds, or they really go right through you to the bone, you know. And, of course, in the winter, some people consider it a pretty lethal place to live.
50, you know? 60 below, very
right.
commonly.
Right.
Summertimes, though, can raise the temperatures up to 70, 80 degrees.
We've been up there when it's been in the high 80s mm-hmm. on the coastal plain. When you get inland a ways, along the coast, you've got the maritime influence and a fair amount of fog and colder temperatures. But once you get 5 to 10 miles inland, the temperatures can get very high, and it can get very buggy, which
lots
I write
of
about.
Mosquitoes.
Lots of mosquitoes, yeah. which drive them the caribou wild at certain times of the year. They mm-hmm. aggregate together in large bunches, and you see them migrating to the coast to get away from the bugs. And actually, they'll pour off the coast, the fringe of tundra there, onto the shore, the narrow band of shoreline that runs along the Beaufort Sea, and they'll actually go out onto the ice floes. You know, we've flown over them and seen them. They look like sunbathers out on these ice cakes in the Beaufort Sea. But at least they get away from the bugs, and that's why they do it. It's not a preferred habitat by any means, but that time of year it certainly is for short term.
If you just tuned in, we're talking with Debbie Miller, who is the author of Midnight Wilderness, published in 1990 by Sierra Club. It is a book about her journeys through ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You mentioned some of the animals who live there or migrate through there. Some live in the area year-round. Others migrate through.
Right.
The caribou, for example, during their calving.
Right. The caribou come there every year. in late May and early June to deliver their calves and to forage, and they're there roughly, you know, June and July, and then they start dispersing and heading south or southeast through the Brooks Range into Canada. You have musk oxen, though, that live there year-round. You have Arctic foxes and wolves, and you have polar bears that come onshore in the fall. The females den on the coastal plain of the refuge. It's one of the greatest concentration areas for land denning sites for polar bears on the North Slope that they have recently found out, which is of great interest. So you have the denning polar bears in the winter and the musk oxen that are there year-round.
When you talk about a great concentration of polar bear, are you talking, how many are you talking? What is a great concentration?
I'm not sure of the exact number, but I think in recent years they've documented something in the neighborhood of maybe 20 dens, which is a fairly, I guess, high number of dens, mm-hmm. considering that most of the bears den offshore mm-hmm. on the pack ice. For some reason, they're attracted to that area, and they're looking at that right now. Scientists are studying that issue. So,
how far do the caribou migrate? Some tremendous number of miles every year, is that right?
They have the longest known migration of any terrestrial mammal in the world that's been documented by the use of satellite radio collars. And the average that they've come up with, average figure, is 2,700 miles a year. So they are wanderers.
They're walking all year long,
mm-hmm. you know. And then they dig, you know, through snow much of the year in search of lichens, which is their main, you know, food source in the winter.
Protein-rich lichens are.
Right. It's a real... sure if it's protein or carbohydrates. Now I've forgotten. I have to go back. Forget the, you know, the details. But they are tremendous walkers and cover a lot of ground. And in August, they are dispersing south of the Brooks Range. And when we used to live in Arctic Village, it was a traditional time of year when people would go out and hunt and watch for the caribou. And that's been going on for centuries. Mm-hmm. A number of caribou fences are still standing around Arctic Village. Before rifles came into the picture, they used to corral them in these caribou fences.
Build a long keyhole fence, right?
Right.
So the caribou would wander in?
Right. And that was their way of securing them. Then they would set snares and actually spear them, you know, before there were rifles. Mm-hmm. And like I say, a lot of those fences are still intact. You can spot them from the air or on the ground. And so they've been doing this for centuries, these long migrations. And there are patterns to them. The native people have learned over the years where to be at the right time when they come through.
Some 40 years ago, in the early 1950s, a couple of U.S. wildlife biologists, if I'm right, did the first surveys and made the first proposals to the United States government that chunk of land we call ANWR now be set aside.
Right.
I want to look at the history of how that area got set aside and why.
I think it's a very fascinating history. The two people that you're talking about are George Collins and Lowell Sumner did a tremendous amount of work up there looking at that area. And I think what very few people realize is that up until the late 1950s, everything north of the crest of the Brooks Range was part of a huge military withdrawal. During World War II in 1943, by executive order, the Secretary of Interior withdrew the whole entire North Slope and some of the foothill country in the Brooks Range for military purposes. They wanted to protect all the minerals that lay beneath the ground because it was a time of war. Mm-hmm. That changed after the war was over, and the Department of Interior started looking at the idea of maybe setting aside some of these areas for possible preserves, returning some of the federal land to state ownership. And they looked at a number of options. In 1957, though, that was the year that the secretary said, hey, it's time to give some of this land back to the state of Alaska for resource development. So lo and behold, what he decided to do, this was Secretary of Interior Fred Seaton during the Eisenhower administration. Mm-hmm. He proclaimed that the 23 million acre National Petroleum Reserve should stay intact. That had been established back in the 1920s, and that should stay for military, whatever, naval purposes as a reserve gas, oil and gas reserve. Then he said, well, we'll give the state 20 million acres, the central Arctic zone, roughly between the Colville River mm-hmm. and the Canning River, which mm-hmm. is the western boundary of the Arctic refuge. And then basically a scant 5 million acres would eventually become part of the Arctic National Wildlife Range that was established in 1960. So the state, there were many people, including a lot of supporters in Fairbanks. Even the Fairbanks Daily News Miner came out with an editorial in support of this idea that, hey, the state's going to get 20 million acres. And underneath this ground at that time, nobody knew, lay the giant Prudhoe Bay super oil field, as well as the Kuparuk and all these other oil fields that are up there, some that have yet to be tapped, such as West Sac and New Sands. And all this is the state land that Secretary Seaton, and President Eisenhower relinquished to the state back in the late 50s.
Had Seaton only known.
Yeah, right. If they only had known. So there was quite a compromise. I mean, it was a fair compromise. Many people thought that at the time that the Arctic Range was established, there was a big battle to establish the range. A number of people that live in Alaska were involved in that battle, people that still live in Fairbanks, such as people like Celia Hunter, Jenny Wood testified before Congress, and many residents that I think in Fairbanks that are still alive today that were on one side or the other. The state was against the idea of an Arctic range. They thought it would curtail resource development.
Right. The governor at the time was a territorial governor, was very strong development. I've lost his name, but I remember that was the case.
Right. Yeah. Like I say, it was a battle. It was the typical type of scene that we're seeing today with the Alaska delegation. At that time, it was Bartlett and Greening that were very opposed to the idea of having any sort of preserve in northeastern Alaska. And then you had the state and your mineral, Department of Natural Resources and mineral developers that wanted to keep the area open. But then you had a number of people that thought, this might not be a bad idea, that maybe we should leave a chunk of wilderness set aside, for the wildlife and for recreational purposes. And that, 20 million acres was a fairly good chunk of land for the state, and it turned out to be the best chunk.
Superior.
Yeah.
Were the arguments very much as they are today with people arguing that a reserve of some sort should be set aside of wilderness for wilderness sake, and the other side saying, no, we must develop all the resources we can for the sake of the state of Alaska's economy or national security, balance of debt, et cetera.
The same exact scenario from looking back. History definitely repeats itself in this case. I see the same things repeating now with our Alaska delegation lobbying very hard in Congress, trying to get this last remnant, virgin section of coastal plain opened up to the oil companies, which puzzles me so much because the state has so much of its own land that is still yet to be explored around the Prudhoe Bay area. But it was quite a fight, and it was the final hour of the Eisenhower administration in 1960 when Secretary Seaton and Eisenhower decided that it was not going to get through Congress because of the opposition on the part of Greening and Bartlett. So they established the Arctic Range, which at that time was about 8 point something million acres, and that was set aside by executive order.
Let's take just a minute to define terms. There is a range. Mm-hmm. There is a refuge.
Very confusing.
There is capital W wilderness. What do the various designations mean?
The Arctic National Wildlife Range, the original range, I think it was meant to be more of a range for wildlife. I mean, you have these tremendous, caribou herds coming through, and by definition of how Department of Interior differentiates a refuge and a range, I'm not really quite sure. Mm. Back in the late 50s, there was the Kenai Moose Range, and they used that term more frequently. When the Arctic Range was reestablished, and expanded in 1980, 20 years later, they changed the name to a refuge and doubled the size of it. But basically, whether you call it a range or a refuge, the idea is that it is a wildlife sanctuary, and it was established for the purpose of preserving the wilderness, the wildlife, and the recreational values. That was the purpose of establishment originally. And those still hold true today. I mean, that's the underlying line purpose as to why we have an original Arctic preserve up there. So,
when ANILCA came into being, some restrictions were added or some descriptions of how the land was to be used and in what interests. That seems to be important in its history as well. Do you think so?
Oh, yes, because things changed considerably with the passage of ANILCA. Most of the original Arctic National Wildlife Range was proclaimed as wilderness, which protects it from all development, which gives you the strongest protection And then the addition to the Arctic Range on the southern portion, the area surrounding Arctic Village and going down towards the Yukon River, that area right now it's just in a I'm trying to think what they refer to it as. I need a Fish and Wildlife Service person here to tell me the actual title that they're giving it now, but I don't want to say it's multiple use because that's not what it is, but it's sort of in limbo. They're developing a management plan right now, and I don't think they have an actual category for it yet. Mm-hmm. But development can occur on the southern portions. I mean, that's a possibility. It doesn't have the full protection as wilderness would. Mm-hmm. And then you have the limbo area in 1980 that Congress decided that the 1.5 million acre section of the coastal plain, that area be assessed in terms of its biological importance and its oil and gas, assessment as well. So that was looked at between 1980 and 1985. They did a number of studies, biological studies and oil and gas seismic work on the coastal plain to determine what should happen to that zone. Should it become a part of the wilderness area, or should it be opened up for oil and gas development? And we know what has happened to date. Most people, I think, realize that the decision was made at the higher levels, that is, it was recommended by the Department of Interior that the entire 1.5 million acre section be opened up for oil and gas exploration and development during the Reagan administration.
What are the arguments against that from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, it's I think first you have to look at what you're losing. And I think the losses would be, tremendous. It'd be a tragedy as far as the way I view that corner of Alaska. It is the wildest region that's left on the earth. When you combined the Yukon National Park, which is roughly 3 million acres, and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that comprises the largest chunk of wild habitat in the world. So we're talking about a world-class refuge, and there's no other conservation unit in the world that protects the kind of habitats that are in the Arctic Refuge, that has the diversity of wildlife and the true wilderness. It is pure wilderness. It really, my husband and I, before we moved to Alaska, we spent a great deal of time taking kids out on outdoor education trips through the Sierra, the Cascades, the Canadian Rockies, and Selkirks. And we had wonderful wilderness experiences, but nothing is comparable to what you experience in the Arctic Refuge because it's completely untouched. It's a virgin country. Any of the areas in the lower 48, as we call it, you're going to have established trails and you're going to hear the sounds of civilization somewhere in the distance. It's just not quite the same. You don't have the essence of wilderness that you do up here. So that's a great loss, in my estimation, to lose that wilderness character. It would be gone. It's irreversible. You can't have an oil field and maintain the wilderness values. Secondly, I think the wildlife would be in great jeopardy. It was noted in the congressional report to Congress that the porcupine caribou herd would likely be displaced, possibly a reduction in population, because this is a very narrow swath of coastal plain.
It's 100 miles by 38 miles, something
right,
like that.
Right, 25 to 30 miles wide, yeah. 100 miles long, and it's a much smaller zone with a higher density of caribou than, say, the Prudhoe Bay area where you have a smaller herd. The central Arctic herd, now they're estimating, is at 25,000 animals, and it wanders in and around Prudhoe Bay, but it's had the good fortune of adjacent lands that it has been able to pour into, and they've been displaced from the immediate industrialized zone. At least the cows and the calves dislike the human disturbance, but they've had adjacent lands to move into. And the porcupine caribou herd would not have that much space as far as that particular zone because it is such a narrow area and it's a preferred habitat for them. So
one of the arguments actually for I've heard for developing the coastal plain is that there were great fears of displacement and jeopardization of the caribou herd around Prudhoe, and that herd has actually prospered in the last 15 years or so. And you would say that argument just doesn't hold water for the coastal plain?
I don't think it holds water. I don't think you can compare. I think it's like comparing apples and oranges. You have a different set of factors when you look at the coastal plain and the Arctic Refuge and you look at the area around Prudhoe Bay. you have a herd that is roughly 180,000 animals in the porcupine caribou herd, you know, seven times the size of the Central Arctic herd. And the area that they occupy on the coast is just a much, much smaller, mm-hmm. smaller zone. You have huge concentrations of animals, 40, 50, 60,000. This summer, 100,000 animals gathered together. We've never seen that in the Prudhoe Bay Area, those kinds of concentrations. And what a network of roads and pipelines and drilling pads would do would be extremely disruptive. I think most people would agree that it's a different set of factors. And recent studies have shown that the Central Arctic herd is not doing quite so well as people have thought in the past. The rate of growth is not as it was in the late 70s and early 80s. The rate of growth has decreased. And there's some question now as to there are two different segments of the herd, one that occupies the area east of the Sagavanirktok River, which is an undeveloped area largely. And there's a segment of the population that's in and around the Prudhoe Bay Area. And they're looking very closely at those two segments, and they're beginning to see some differences in rate of reproduction and their preliminary findings at this point. But I think they need to take a closer look over time.
Once again, you're listening to Conversations on KUAC-FM. We're talking today with Debbie Miller, who is the author of Midnight Wilderness, a book on her journeys through the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Since we're talking about caribou, you mentioned that there was a passage or perhaps two from right. Midnight Wilderness you could look at. Maybe we could read from that.
I'll pick a section here that I'm very fond of. Dennis and I have spent years going into the Arctic Refuge since 1975, and we were always hoping to be on the ground when 10, 20, 30,000 caribou would come by. And this happened probably 5 or 6 years ago when we were lucky enough to be on the ground and to be encircled by these animals. And I'll read that passage. This is out on the coastal plain. This is in near the 1002 controversial area where they want to put the oil field. Some people do, anyway. As I look east across the sweep of tundra toward the Canadian border, about 40 miles away, I see the entire horizon waver through heat waves as if we are on a desert plain. At first glance, the liquid figures bubbling up from the tundra appear to be only part of a huge mirage. Looking closer, I realize that this is more than an illusion. It is a living, breathing, pulsating mass of animals. Through the heat waves, thousands of silhouetted caribou are melting into the sky. My heart races. A large segment of the porcupine caribou herd is moving toward us. Although we have spent portions of many years within the Arctic Refuge, we've never been lucky enough to observe large numbers of aggregating caribou from the ground. It is a chance of a lifetime. I fumble for my camera, but I'm too overwhelmed to think about light meters and viewfinders. Caribou by the thousands are coming toward us. The spectacle fills my mind, as does the landscape in front of me. Forget the pictures. Shoulder to shoulder, they stream across the tundra, a tide of undulating bodies, gracefully moving across miles of tussock-covered terrain. A whispering chant of grunts and bleats fills the summer air in rhythm with the herd's steady pace. As they come closer, the voices grow louder. It's difficult to judge distances on this expansive coastal plain, but they appear to be less than 1 mile away. My heart continues to race as I stand spellbound. They are coming closer. The sounds grow louder. One of the world's greatest wildlife spectacles. And we are here to witness it. The minutes seem like hours. Soon the tundra before us is flooded with caribou. There is barely a trace of ground through the mass and clutter of hooves. Where the tundra appeared empty only a few minutes ago, now it is a moving mass of flesh and blood. Month-old lanky calves bleat for their mothers. Mothers extend their necks and muzzles, mooing for their calves. Most of the caribou are cows with calves, although we spot a number of yearlings, juveniles, and bulls mixed in with the herd. As the caribou approach, the vocal sounds of the animals are as overwhelming as the scene itself. In addition to the cattle-like bleating and mooing, there is a tremendous amount of grunting, snorting, bellowing, and even coughing. The sounds are somewhat reminiscent of the time when, as a teenager, I had the exciting opportunity to assist with a cattle roundup on a Montana ranch. I still remember the din of the cattle's voices as we funneled the animals into a corral. Yet the sounds of the caribou are more varied. Perhaps the most unique sound is the strange clicking of hooves. No other member of the deer family produces this kind of clicking, which resembles the sound of castanets or of drumsticks beating one another. The sound is caused by a springing ligament, characteristic in ungulates, that slips over bones within the hoof when the caribou walks. The clicking of tens of thousands of hooves, blending with a variety of vocalizations in rhythm with the herd's gait, creates a caribou symphony on the tundra. So, kind of gives you a little glimpse of what it was like.
Debbie Miller reading from Midnight Wilderness. Again, this is a Sierra Cub book published in 1990. You mentioned that this earth needs wilderness for the sake of wilderness, simply, that is one argument for not developing the coastal plain.
Right.
Another major concern of yours is the displacement of the caribou, porcupine caribou herd.
And other animals, too, I should add to that, not just the caribou, but say the polar bears that den there. They're extremely sensitive to disturbance when they're during the denning season. The muskoxen that are there year-round, the hundreds of thousands of birds that come to nest and to stage there. You've got quite a variety of wildlife that uses that area. And for brief periods of time, say in the summer, you've got this intense burst of life. What I'm trying to get at is there's a lot more at stake than just the caribou. I think the caribou get a lot of attention in this argument. And there are a lot of other animals that live up there besides the caribou.
It's something of a public relations disadvantage. They live in the far northwest corner of the earth. They're not seen. The impact of their lives is not felt very far south of the Brooks Range. And in the other corner, as they say in boxing, are 260-some million people wanting to sustain an oil-based, pretty definitely oil-based lifestyle.
Right.
And what we call these external threats, one of which we've witnessed in the last couple of weeks with Iraq invading Kuwait, all of a sudden choking off some of the oil that we receive at a price we were comfortable with. The odds aren't good in that ring, it seems to me.
No, the odds are, I think in some ways, they're against us, especially with this Mideast crisis. It was bound to happen. I think we're foolish not to realize that two-thirds of the world's oil reserves lie in the Mideast. It's an unstable area. We need to wean ourselves from oil and become more energy efficient in other ways, you know, by using alternative sources of energy and by using more fuel-efficient cars.
Now, those who would argue for development would say, Debbie, we can't do this soon. I mean, we have a crisis in the Middle East now, and we're not going to change our lifestyle to a more conservative one in the next couple of years when we will need that oil. We need another find, whether it is big as Prudhoe was or whether it is simply a good-sized gamble, which is what the coastal plain is. Your response?
My response to that would be, I think you have to approach it in three phases, basically. First, we need to conserve the energy. And there are things that can be done now, technologically, to save oil. We don't have to wait for the right model car to be produced that will get 40, 50, 60, 70 miles a gallon. Those cars already exist. I mean, they're ready to go online and be produced in masses by the Japanese. They're way ahead of us.
Volvo also has one, I think.
And Volvo has one. And just a figure to throw out that I think will impress people, if we increased our fuel economy standards to 40 miles per gallon for cars and for 30 miles per gallon for light trucks by the year 2000, we would save four Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And that would be between the year 2000 and 2020. Volvo has a four-passenger car that gets 71 miles per gallon.
The national standard is something like 25 miles a gallon now. Jimmy Carter pushed it up to 27 or 28. Ronald Reagan pushed it back down to 25.
Yeah.
And that difference from what you're saying seems to have created a need for using such undeveloped oil fields as Anwar. So we're now hungry for oil because we're
building bigger cars. You know, Chrysler and some of these car companies are building larger cars, bigger engines that use more petrol. You know, somebody referred to them once as petrol pigs, and that's really what they are. We don't really need to have large gas-eating cars, though, when we have especially in our situation where most of our oil reserves are in the Mideast and it's an unstable area and we don't want to be dependent upon those imports. If we are more efficient, not only with cars, but with insulation using better, more super insulated windows and these kinds of measures, it's going to make an immediate difference. If this argument of open the Arctic refuge, we're in a crisis, we need the oil, first of all, they have to explore for the oil, and they've got to get it online if there is oil. And you've got to look at the facts in the case. There's a 1 in 5 chance of finding oil in the first place. And they estimate that a mean estimate of 3.2 billion barrels of oil is what they estimate that might lie beneath the ground. Mm-hmm. And that would contribute to roughly 1.8% of what we use in this country each year over the 30-year life of such an oil field.
So looking at ANWR isn't necessarily looking at some sort of oil savior.
No. In fact, I think Christopher Flavin said it best with the World Watch Institute when he said that developing the Arctic refuge to help solve our energy crisis is like trying to fight a fire with a teacup. You know, that's really what it is. It's peanuts. Something else that comes into the picture here now, it may be a good time to bring it up, and this is another phase I was talking about, different ways to approach. Conservation is one thing we can do, using more energy-efficient cars, insulation, and taking simple measures that people can do in the coming years to wean ourselves from this horrible, insatiable appetite for oil. Individuals can do these things. You know, we don't have to wait for a corporation to do it. We can help along those lines. The second phase, though, is that we have a number of existing fields, not only in Alaska but in Texas, and enhanced recovery techniques have really improved in recent years. They can get more oil out of the ground than they could 10 years ago. We need to go to those areas, including areas on the North Slope, and we need to use those techniques and squeeze every last drop out of the oil where we have the infrastructure already in place. You know, why go into virgin areas when you can get more oil out of these existing fields? And then the other thing that I think that's important to note is that the state of Alaska, as part of that, 20 million acre block of land that we talked about that was relinquished to the state in the late 50s, the state still holds the majority of those lands. BLM has a portion, and there's some native inholdings, but largely the state owns the block of land in that central Arctic area. And there are roughly 4 million acres that have yet to be leased to the oil industry. There are lease sales that are scheduled now and in the coming, next 5 years, that the industry has gone on record as they're in support of these sales. They're interested in these sales. Fred Pratt had a column in the newspaper noting one sale, Sale 77, that borders the pipeline corridor, and there's an interest in that zone. There are two or three other large lease sales that have yet to come, on the books.
In the case of Sale 77, because it lies adjacent to the existing line, it would be fairly easy, from at least what Fred Pratt said in the Newsminer article, to tap in.
Right. And there's another area that will be up for lease just southwest of the Kuparuk field, the White Hills Sale, and that has moderate potential. That's an area that's a little less than 1 million acres. Again, we're talking millions of acres that have yet to be explored. And these are areas that border existing fields where the infrastructure is already set. We've got the roads, the network. Why go into a wilderness area such as the Arctic Refuge when you can tap these existing fields? The West Sac field, now that the price of oil has gone up, which ARCO has been for years saying we can't develop West Sac until it becomes economically feasible, recoverable, with the oil prices going up. And now here's a perfect case. Why not go in and tap that zone? They know that the oil is there, and it rivals Prudhoe Bay in its quantity. So there are a number of good arguments not to go into the Arctic Refuge. And the state, it's in the state's best interest, as far as Alaskans go, to develop our own state lands and not be advocating for development on adjacent federal lands. We get a better share in the way of revenues from the leases and the taxes and bonuses and so forth, royalties.
With that in mind, why the lust for the coastal plain?
Personally, I think it's greed.
Because it may be such a large field?
I think there's thought that there are some large formations beneath the coastal plain. An ARCO representative referred to them as containers. They call them containers. They might be empty, and they might be full. And of course they want to look. If I was an industry person, I would want access to as much land as is available. Have all the full deck of cards in front of me. And if there's hope for a major discovery, I would want to go in there too, but it doesn't make it right. You know, you have to draw the line somewhere. And that line, I think, should be the Canning River, you know, because of the compromises been made in the past.
So you don't object to drilling. You don't object to oil development in this state. You object to oil development on a pristine area of land.
I think we have to have a balance, you know. Oil is going to be around for a while, and I think we're going to be developing our oil resources for a while. But that doesn't mean that we have to give away the entire North Slope to the industry or the entire Outer Continental Shelf and in these sensitive areas to the industry. I think we have to be very careful, proceed with caution, do more detailed environmental assessments than we have had in the past, regulate more than we have in the past. Prudhoe Bay was out of sight and out of mind for years, and very little monitoring of what went on up there. And there are a lot of problems associated with Prudhoe Bay and what's been left up there. A lot of problems that still need to be solved before you consider drilling in new areas.
Many people say, do the exploratory drilling now, so we know at least what the odds are.
I would argue against it, because I know what's involved with exploratory drilling. I've seen just one exploratory well that's just a little southeast of Kaktovik on native lands, and it's an ugly postage stamp. And I even talked to a Chevron representative that said it was a poor job. They could have done it better, and it's an ugly mess. It takes millions of tons of gravel and water to just do one exploratory well. You're talking about a lot of equipment and manpower, and it's not a little operation. It's not like you go up there with a willow wand, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that as a solution or as a viable option. Particularly, and I think this is the key, if there were no other places left to look for oil and gas, I might understand the logic of maybe we should go into the Arctic Refuge, but that is simply not the case. There is so much available state land and Outer Continental Shelf land that has been opened or will be opened in the future to the oil industry. And it simply is unreasonable to open up a new pristine area when you already have lease sales that are scheduled in the state of Alaska's 5-year oil and gas leasing plan that comes out yearly. Every year I take a look at that plan and I'm always amazed. A dozen federal sales, a dozen state lease sales. We're talking millions of acres where they have the opportunity to look at lands that are categorized as having low to moderate potential. Some are lower than others, but it seems, like I say, the compromise in my mind has been made back in the late 50s, and I think it still holds true today.
Developers and those who support developers will call environmentalists special interest groups. And the implication is that you do not represent the interests of the people, that you're off in a corner fighting for some small and, by the tone of voice, one would assume less significant special interest. How do you respond to that?
I think I would disagree, obviously, because I think we do heed to the word of the people. I think you look at tourism in Alaska, which is, I believe, either the third or fourth largest industry in the state. You're going to continue having visitors to the state, and they come up here to see the wilderness. They come up here to see the parks, the refuges, the wildlife. They don't come up here to see oil rigs, you know. We've got an opportunity in this state. Thank goodness a person like Jimmy Carter had the vision to realize that in the coming years people were going to come to visit these areas. And both, we're talking about Alaskans and Americans that come to see what we have here in the way of wilderness. I think some people take it for granted in this state. They think we have so much of it that we can go and just have resource development wherever we want and keep feeding this appetite that we have for oil so that we can maintain our 85%, you know, of our revenues for our state budget. Sooner or later, we have to realize that what we have here, we have to protect. We have to preserve what we have. Each year, we get more visitors to the state. That's more dollars coming into the state. And fisheries, our fisheries industry, look at that, what they've had to suffer from Exxon Valdez. I mean, that was a real rude awakening. It happened. It wasn't supposed to happen. So you've got to look at, you have to look beyond the dollar, I guess, is what I'm getting at. I mean, the oil industry, talk about special interest. I mean, they're the most powerful special interest group mm-hmm. in the world, really.
The polls say, the survey says, most people in this state would support oil development in general because it's good for our economy. Do you think that they're asking, that the poll takers are asking the wrong questions?
I think you're going to get mixed results. I think there are people that favor oil development. But I think you have many, many people that don't speak out on the issue. I come across people all the time that are strong believers in that we don't need to go into the Arctic Refuge to open up this wildlife sanctuary for oil and gas development. And I'm talking a sort of a cross-section of people, you know, doctors, bankers, lawyers that I've talked to that it's foolish. You know, we have our own state lands that we can develop, and there are other areas, less sensitive areas, that we can go into. You've got to have a balanced approach to development in the state. And I think most, maybe not all conservationists, not all environmentalists, maybe have that balanced approach. There may be some that are very radical that say no development whatsoever, but I think the majority of people realize that you have to compromise, that you mm-hmm. are going to have resource development, but you want it done in the best, most environmentally sound way, and that some places you just have to draw the line. And I guess in this case, I can't feel more strongly that we have to draw the line in the case of the Arctic Refuge because of what's at stake and because we've made the compromise already. We've drawn the line already.
There's a group of people in the United States recently, they may have been around for quite a while, and I've just begun to hear about them, who call themselves environmental extremists. And their view, if I can capsulize it, is that the animals, the trees, other growing things have fairly close to equal rights with human beings. We should not disturb at all the natural places where things grow and wander. Mm-hmm. What is your sense of them, of that group of people in the environmental movement? Are they a distraction or a disturbance from your perspective, or is their message an important one?
Well, I guess I would answer that by saying I think you've got, they're at one end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that you have, that you have that radical element, because it may offset the other radical element, which would be develop everything. You know, so in some ways, maybe it's good to have that segment that fights. It may not be a very pragmatic, approach. We've got 5 billion people on the Earth. I mean, that's the reality. It's pretty impossible for us to have no effect, at this stage in the game. I think there's probably, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, about how in order to have change, you have to have that radical element to bring about awareness, and that somewhere in the middle is where you end up going. Mm-hmm. That's the path you end up taking. And I think that's probably how I would respond to, those groups that are advocating that. Right.
One more developer versus environmentalist question.
It's too bad they're so polarized all the time, because there are a number of people that are that want to preserve wilderness, that they want to maintain those values, and yet they realize. I mean, most of us realize. I drive a car. Mm. I drive a Subaru. I mean, it's a fairly efficient car. I could drive a more efficient car, which I'm inclined the next car I probably should. I think most of us realize that we use energy and that we need a certain amount of resource development. It's just that it's how we go about doing it and where and what level, and the greed factor comes in. The greed factor, the profit-making, I think factor comes in. When I think of the North Slope, Jimmy Carter, I think, put it best when he was up visiting our camp in the Arctic Refuge. He said, during my administration, we gave 95% of everything north of the Brooks Range. We made it, to be eventually available at one time or another to the oil industry. It's the 5% more that they want. I mean, we're getting down to a matter of greed here.
There are people, not just developers, there are people in the world who will say, if you dedicate a piece of land, a good portion of 19 million acres or so, for refuge, what you're doing is you're making it a preserve for upper-middle-class people who can afford to get up there and hike. No one else in the United States is going to be able to have access to that land. And they will say that you don't have the right to it any more than you say developers have the right to it. What's your response to that? That you are a privileged few by being able to make your 15 annual visits to that area?
Well, first off, I would say I do feel very privileged, and I feel extremely fortunate that I've been able to go into that area. It's largely been because of our work and our priorities. And we set aside funds to go up there every year. And my husband works up there, which helps a great deal. It gets him up there because he's based doing wildlife survey work. And of course, we taught there, and so we had access to the area. And we are fortunate. We are lucky. And I have taken groups into the Arctic Refuge. I've met probably hundreds of people that at one time or another over the last 15 years that have gone into the refuge, and they consider it the most wonderful wilderness experience of their life. It's a treasurable experience that they're never going to forget. I've had people write me stating this, you know, in letters about how absolutely fantastic their experience was, and that they're so glad that they spent those resources, that they, you know, went up there. And then, maybe to answer to the people that will never go there, I got a phone call a few months back from a stranger in Oklahoma who had picked up my book from a library, and he had never had the opportunity to visit the Arctic Refuge. And he was an elderly man, probably in his 70s or 80s, it sounded like. And he called me just to thank me for sharing the dream of Alaska with him, because it was something that he had always had dreamed to do, was to go and spend time in the Arctic Refuge, and he never had the opportunity. He had worked in Alaska at one time, like 40 years ago, and he said, thanks for keeping the dream alive for me. And that made me feel so wonderful, you know, that there are people that do cherish the dream. They may never visit the area, but just knowing that a wild zone exists, and that it's protected as an ecosystem for all of these animals that have used it for centuries. There's something that I think Wallace Stegner maybe said it best. He references wilderness as being the geography of hope. And I think that's very well put. I mean, we need to know that there are places where man cannot go and leave industrial footprints.
Will you read for us again? You mentioned before we began, unless another one strikes you up, a passage about Robin and the wolf, your eldest daughter.
Okay, we'll go to the wolf section here. When Robin was our first daughter, when she was 1 year old, she had just turned one, we took her on her first trip to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and she actually learned to walk on the tundra, you know, bouncing around on the tussocks, and she did quite well. It was a struggle at first, and then the longer she was up there, the better she got, you know. Easy place to fall down. Tussocks are wonderful, provide a wonderful cushion. And we had been out on the Achillic River, this was, in the foothills, the northern foothills of the Brooks Range. We had been out for about 2 weeks, and we entered a period that got extremely hot in the 80s. The caribou were beginning to aggregate on the coastal plain. And the bugs were at their worst. I'll get a sip of water here so I don't choke as I read.
Sure.
And this is waking up on the Achillic. We awakened. This was just, by the way, just Robin and I were out at camp. Dennis was based in, my husband was based in Kaktovik, working on the caribou project. We awakened early from intense heat, like two pots baked in a kiln. With temperatures in the 80s, this is the hottest day so far. It is dead calm, and I suspect the caribou must be running for the coast to cool off and seek relief from the swarming insects. This buggy hot day should drive the caribou together to begin their post-calving aggregation. I suspect Dennis is out flying with other biologists, closely tracking the herd's movements in preparation for a census count. Robin and I walk up to a bluff above camp to scout for caribou. The mosquitoes form thick, aggravating clouds around our heads, and without bug repellent, we would be devoured. With little precipitation in recent weeks, the tundra is already dry and many plants are going to seed. The grasses and sedges are so crisp that they crunch beneath my feet. It's as though I'm walking on soda crackers. During our first week on the Achillic, we have watched clumps of violet shooting stars reach their blooming peak, wither, and die. The white heather along a southeast-facing cut bank has come and gone. The tiny bell-shaped blossoms have turned to miniature paper lanterns. We discover a caribou carcass from last winter. The rib cage is partially intact, and its two jawbones lie face to face. Caribou fur is scattered everywhere, and wolf tracks surround the site. I wonder if the animal was killed by wolves or by another predator, or if it died of natural causes. Back at camp, we drink lemonade by the quart and create some shade by placing Robin's poncho over the spotting scope tripod. Shade is a real problem. Just pause here and mention that when it gets up into the 80s, the only shade you can find is what little shade your tent provides, or in this case, we put a poncho over a spotting scope and smother the sunscreen on, you know, a one-year-old. It's, without trees, and no clouds either, so we were really roasting. While we sweat in the heat, four ravens fly just over our heads and cackle at us. Robin looks up smiling and waves at them as they make cartwheels in the sky. She calls to them, "Da, die, die, da, da, die." It is the first time Robin has ever observed ravens at close range, and the first time she has ever spontaneously waved at any creature, including man. After Robin's morning nap, it is hotter yet. We walk to a sandbar along the river, and Robin makes prints with her tiny feet next to the caribou tracks. A quick plunge in the frigid water cools us off. Robin is delighted that she can run naked and freely on the sand, looking at animal tracks and bird feathers, picking up rocks. At this point, you might be wondering how I could let my daughter run naked on the sand with swarms of mosquitoes. But it was so hot at this point in the day, when it gets up into the 80s, midday, the mosquitoes are grounded for the most part. They come out when the temperature starts dropping a little bit lower. You know, not much lower, but it was too hot for them to fly. It was one of those days. In the late afternoon, we are still drinking lemonade and watching cumulus clouds build up over the mountains. These are the first clouds we have seen in more than 5 days. I hope they will come our way and provide some needed shade. Robin and I sit in what little shade the tent and hanging poncho provide. Even though she is well covered with baby sunscreen, I still worry about the intense sun. Suddenly, I notice something moving in the willow bushes. The hump of some blonde, furry animal is about 300 yards from our tent. For a moment, I think it's a small grizzly, and my heart starts pounding. Within a few seconds, I see it's a wolf with its head lowered, pawing at the ground. At first glance, all that was visible was its light-colored back. The wolf gradually walks our way, and we remain motionless next to the tent. Robin spots the approaching creature, a dog in her mind, when it is about 100 yards from our tent. The wolf draws closer and closer, walking very slowly with its tongue hanging out, panting in the mid-afternoon heat. Its fur is bleached white and mangy as it is shedding its old coat. The wolf looks tattered and tired after a long day on the prowl. The closer the wolf approaches, the more excited Robin becomes. She stands on her feet and starts to babble. I explain to her that it's a wild dog and tell her she can't pet it. This makes no sense to her. She wants to charge over to the animal and give it a big hug. So I grab the back of her t-shirt to hold her in place and caution her in a whisper to keep still. The wolf approaches within 40 yards of the tent. I paste it off later. This is the closest encounter I've ever had with a wolf, and I'm mesmerized. As the wolf comes parallel with us, Robin calls out in a loud voice, "Da, da, da," and reaches out toward the wild dog. I think she expects the wolf to walk over to her for a pat. She calls a second time, "Da, da," and the wolf stops and stares at Robin for a few moments, although it feels like hours. In all our years in Alaska, I have only heard of one account of a wolf attacking a trapper, yet I still worry that Robin might appear to be just the right sized prey. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I remember reading about a wolf species in India that reportedly nabs little children. Fact or fiction? I guess with some certainty that this wolf has probably never seen a human toddler and is probably just curious. After a long stare at Robin, the wolf continues on past camp, walking a weary pace. A few moments later, Robin calls a third time, and the wolf turns around and looks at her again briefly, and then proceeds up the valley. Robin quietly watches the wolf until it is completely out of sight.
Your heart must have been in your throat.
It was in my throat.
Only daughter, firstborn, calling to a wolf.
Yeah, calling to a wolf. And like I mentioned, that I had never heard of a wolf attacking a person. And that was in the back of my mind. But still, you know, she was so little. And I thought to myself, oh, you know, what if this wolf just gets curious? And so I held her real close to me.
Olas and Margaret Weary took their two-year-old, their firstborn, on a winter trek, dog sleds and all wrapped up. Did you, and they were, of course, asked for many years if they had any concerns about taking their fragile child out on the tundra. Mm-hmm. Had you any concerns about taking Robin out?
I think I was apprehensive at first, particularly since she was the firstborn, and on that first trip when she was had just turned one. I can remember being nervous and making the transition from Fairbanks out to the Atchilik, which is a very long transition time to get on a plane in Fairbanks and go to Kaktovik and, you know, wait for a bush plane ride out into a remote valley. It's hard on children, getting them out there. And then I can remember those first few moments when she got out of the plane and, you know, walked around on that tundra and started looking at all the flowers and picking up sticks and stones on the ground, and that she was so intrigued by this menagerie, or this mosaic is what I'm trying to say, of life and on the tundra, and smiling at these dainty little flowers, you know. And I thought to myself, oh, this is going to be a wonderful environment for her. Mm-hmm. And plus, there weren't any poisonous plants that I could find nearby camp, and I thought to myself, this is probably more safe than having her in my kitchen when she's, you know, trying to get into this or that underneath the, you know, cabinets, you know, the Ajax or what have you.
What caused you to write this book, Midnight Wilderness? It's from your journals. It's from the many years of traveling out to Anwar.
It's based on 13 years of journals, you know, from these summers that we've spent up there since 1975. I'd kept the journals and had thought that I might write a book someday, and then when the issue came to light that the area might be opened up for oil development, I think that was the driving force behind me, that I said it was time to pull out the journals and put it all together. For quite some time, I didn't want to. I thought it was too special a place, that we just cherished it too much, and I didn't want to reveal it to the marketplace, mm-hmm. you know. But with this, it changed my whole perspective, you know, that I had to do it. It was something that was just had to be done. And I'm hoping that it will help. It's hard to say. We'll see what happens in Saudi Arabia tomorrow. And
Debbie Miller, thank you for spending an hour with us on Conversations.
Well, thank you for having me as a guest. I enjoyed it.
Glad to have you here. You've been listening to Conversations on KUAC. Join us again next week. I'm Susan McGinnis.